shit.
I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
But fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof it the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have. And, you know, you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not light. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jimmy McGuinness in his life.
Very welcome back to Off the Ball this Saturday. Neil Tracy filling in for John Duggan this afternoon. We are looking at women in sport because last Sunday was International Women's Day, and we're delighted to be joined by three Pinergy ambassadors. The Pinergy Passions Programme is now in its third year. It was created in 2017 with the aim of supporting young, talented people with a passion by enabling them to dictate more time and focus to their chosen passions. So the three Irish sports people I have with me this afternoon: Michelle Claffey, Irish rugby international. Michelle plays for Blackrock College in Leinster and looking forward to representing Ireland at some point over the next while and maybe reschedule Six Nations games. We might as well say at the moment, we have recorded this on Monday. At the time of recording this, we aren't really certain what's going to be happening this weekend with the women's game against France. The men's game has been called off, but at the moment, preparations for the game against France, and whether or not goes ahead, you will still be training away this week?
Yeah, it's business as usual. We training camp Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and it was very much so the game is going ahead next weekend, so prep was on point this week.
Well, hopefully tomorrow afternoon we'll find out now if this game is going ahead. Also as well, Del, I have Aisling Keller from Tipperary. Aisling qualified Ireland's boat for the Olympic Sailing Regatta after a 7th place finish at the Laser Radial World Championships in Japan last July. So Aisling, you're now focusing on trying to get through and get into that boat that you have qualified for Ireland at the Tokyo Olympics. And I suppose as well, you're probably touch and go wondering, is the Tokyo Olympics going to be going ahead?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm not really like letting that thought come into my head. So if the Olympics
book your ticket first and then worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. I need to book myself into the boat. So that's everything I'm worried about at the moment.
And another person with us this afternoon looking to get to Tokyo this summer, Elva Carroll, triathlete looking to qualify for the games. Elva, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon. I was saying, like Aisling, you're kind of trying to figure out, first of all, get your place for Tokyo and then worry about whether or not it's going to be going ahead.
Absolutely, yeah. Tokyo was very much on my brain at last year, but I've kind of run into a few health issues this year, so it's not so much something that I can really see as an achievable goal at the moment, but I guess you can never say never, so I just have to figure that out and get to the bottom of that and move forward.
Aisling, just to start on the qualifying for Tokyo, because it is probably one of the anomalies of a lot of Olympic sports that you're going hell for leather to actually qualify, first of all, the boat itself, or whether it's an athletics place or something. And even if you do that, you have to go ahead and actually get the selection yourself. It's a bit like, it is a bit of an awkward one.
Yeah, and it's also like, so I qualified the boat, which means any Irish sailor sailing my boat can go. But we also use each other for training purposes and everything. So like, it is a strange one in that, like, obviously I'm happy that Ireland is going to the Olympics and representing sailing and everything. But I want to be in the boat as well, so it's a tough one.
And where are you in the pecking order in terms of getting your place on it?
So over the last 2 years, it's just myself and another girl. And then in September, I think Annalise Murphy announced that she was coming back and she won silver in Rio. So she's sailing pretty well at the moment. But it's between four of us now, and Annalise is sailing quite well, Aoife is sailing quite well, and so it's kind of like, it's hard to say. Annalise, we just had our world championships there in Australia, so Annalise is in the moment or in the lead at the moment, and there's two more regattas to go, so it's hard to say.
Is it strictly like a results business? Is it ranked like that, or is it does it come down to a subjective selection?
It'll only come down to subject selection if you're tied on points at the end, which is really unlikely between three regattas.
Is it tough, or is it a bit more of a relief then that you know it's absolutely down to what you do? It's not going to be someone else's call really at the end of the day. It's kind of down to you. It's in your own hands essentially.
Yeah, that's thinking about uncontrollables like that is just like a worry you don't want. And so to know that it's just your performance at the end of the day, and you can take out politics and all that, that's like, that's a really important thing.
Mm-hmm. Alva, I was reading you're working full time as well. I don't know where the all three of you working full time. How does that work with the work and training balance?
So I'm in quite a fortunate situation. So for the last 5 years, I was actually living in the UK. I moved back over to Ireland in March of last year and started working with Pinergy. I'm there on a part-time basis so that they kind of support me to support my sport, which is great. So it's kind of given me the opportunity to find that balance and to really be able to upskill in an area that I wasn't qualified in beforehand. So I'm working in their marketing department, but my degree at university was sports science, so not really connected. But I've been able to upskill in marketing whilst also like being able to give 100% to my sport and kind of find that balance and just make it work. So it's been quite a good opportunity.
And is that the same then for the two of you?
I work full time in EY as a manager. I'm also doing my master's in education, so I'm doing placement at the minute with college. So I've got work, I've got rugby, and I've got college. So kind of busy.
And where do you find the time to squeeze all that in?
You just have to. You drag yourself out of bed to go to training, whatever. They've changed their schedule around a bit better with Ireland. So we train in the evenings now, so we kind of get more sleep and they're very conscious and they're managing our load. But unfortunately, I have to give college a miss at the weekends because we'd have training camps the majority of the time. But I've taken a lot of my holidays from EY to go and do placement up in Clough and the Hinch and Laytown for the next 6 weeks.
Very good. So like, just talk us through maybe for like an example, a standard Six Nations week.
Yeah.
Where you're working with the Irish team, you're trying to do your day job and you're trying to study as well. Yeah. What's the kind of morning to evening looking like?
Well, Monday's rest from rugby, so it's work as normal. And then Tuesdays, you'd be working like for the whole day. And then evening time would be gym session, followed by an off-feed or non-feed conditioning. Then Wednesday's a rest day. And then Thursday again, either go to club training or again, you know, the gym session. And then Friday afternoons, you go into camp at around 5 o'clock. And you have training then Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it just starts all over again.
And do you miss the bit of free time, or are you someone who likes to stay busy?
I like to stay busy, but then like we had last weekend off due to the Italian match being cancelled, and I was kind of sitting there going, I don't know what to do with myself. And so I binged on Netflix a little bit, and that was the height of it. And I was got to play a club match for Blackrock as well, which is nice to see everyone again.
And Aisling, what's your schedule like? I imagine during the winter as well, it's probably very, very difficult to try and imagine, like, daylight is probably a big thing you need.
Yeah, and somewhat warm weather as well would be pretty handy. But I'm training full time. I kind of was trying to do some modules in college. I'm in Trinity doing physio, but it wasn't, because it's such a hands-on course. And then during the winter, when it's cold here, we train in Portugal. And then in January, February, I was in Australia for regattas and training, so it just wasn't doable. So I just decided last year to cut butt and just focus on training and get into the games.
And are you able to support yourself then based on sponsorship,
yeah,
various karting programs, things like that?
Yeah, exactly. But sailing's a very expensive sport, yeah. So I definitely don't make a profit. I definitely do make a loss, for sure.
I think it's a common thread for a lot of Olympic athletes as well. I think, like,
yeah.
I remember last week we would have been speaking to Phil Healy, the sprinter, and just the sacrifices she's had to make down the years. She was talking about she was working in nursing for a long time as well, and balancing the work commitments and the training commitments. Like, it is incredibly difficult, I would imagine, to just put all those together and, you know, still be in the right frame of mind physically and mentally.
I definitely think, and it's probably the same with you guys, that we know no different. And this is kind of what it's always been like, and you kind of fit everything around your day-to-day life, and you fit family time in and friends time in when you can, and then, well, you put your naps in as often as frequently as possible.
Then the fact that you have been able to kind of concentrate full-time on it, have you noticed considerably your own standards improving greatly because you haven't had the distractions of work commitments?
Yeah, like, the main thing I noticed was my recovery time. Like, when I was studying, anytime I had oh, if I was in the books studying, trying to pass exams and stuff like that. And then summer I could realise like, oh, look, I can go home now and just like go to sleep rather than staying up in the books for a few hours. And it actually, even though you're sitting down studying, it does affect how fast you can recover for training the next day and your next training session. The way I started thinking of it, that was like your training session isn't done until you're recovered for the next one. So that was, and it was like, right, if I'm gonna actually try and get to the games, I may as well drop college for a year, like, mm-hmm. and focus on everything I can do.
And was it like a sliding doors moment where once you started doing it like that, you realize, God, imagine if I'd been able to do this for a little bit longer.
Yeah, exactly. And it actually started when I had an anatomy exam and I couldn't change it, and it was in the middle of a regatta, and I was just like, do you know what, life's too short for it to be stressed all the time, so I'm just gonna cut butt now and get my physio degree in a year later or 2 years later.
So have you been able to defer that for a little while as well?
Yeah. I must get on to Trinity now soon and say hello. I'm coming back.
And Alva, your own, you mentioned there you're kind of working part-time, so you've been able to juggle things around. What's your kind of training schedule like? What's the commitment needed? I imagine it's quite high for triathlon.
Yeah, so we obviously have 3 sports to train. So it's not quite triple the workload, but it is quite an intensive week. So we'll swim maybe 4 times a week, so they're kind of early morning, so you're in the pool at 6:30. I'll ride somewhere between 4 and 5 times a week, so that could be anywhere up to maybe 12-14 hours, and then depending on where we are in the program, be it winter, summer, coming closer to race, whatever it might be, running kind of has little ups and downs as it comes, but yeah, it could be anywhere like 4 to 6 hours, so a week could be 20-25 hours, and then you're obviously then recovery time from that is huge as well. Recovery time isn't necessarily something that you think of when you're training, because you just think of the time needed to get to the session, do the session and get back. But if you're not recovering, the next session isn't going to be what the session could be. So naps are important, very important. I kind of have the opportunity. I don't go into work until maybe 10, half 10. So I get the opportunity to get a nap after an early morning session, go in, do my working day, come back, do another session or two in the evening. So that's kind of the layout of a day or a week.
It's a fine early start that you're getting a nap in like pre-10, half 10.
Yeah, I get my nap in before most people have woken up probably. So yeah, it's kind of nice going back to bed knowing you've already banked a good session and yeah, people haven't woken up yet. So
Michelle, like like what Aisling was saying about, you know, the being able to commit to it full time and stuff like that. I think what a lot of people would have noticed on the Irish team maybe over the last few months, particularly in the Six Nations, is the few of the players that are over in England playing in the Premiership. Like, it's so evident how much higher their standards have improved over the last year or so. Like Anna Kappas at Harlequins, Cliona Maloney at Wasps as well. You can see that playing in such a high standard league and being able to commit to it on more or less a full-time basis, just like what it can do for an athlete.
Yeah, but like same, they've made sacrifices as well, and they've like packed up their lives and they've moved to London, and they do love it, and they get to play rugby every single day, and they get to work, and they get to recover quite well. So it's different for them, and it suits them. So it's brilliant, and they bring all their skills back and their knowledge back, and they implement then into the Irish setup, and the girls can really see the benefit of it. Both themselves, the team, and other players can get their learnings on them. So they do bring back their skills. So we're all learning from it, and it's brilliant.
How far away do you think like the Irish provinces could be from getting to a situation where they could be competing like on a full-time basis with the likes of the teams over in England?
So the new AIL is starting next year, so you had to apply to be in the AIL for next year. So they are changing the structure, they are looking at underlying infrastructure, they are looking at the support services that are there between the clubs, because we're more so club-based than provincial-based. So we only have our Interpros once a year between Leinster, Munster, Connacht, Ulster. And it's great that the clubs are kind of investing more within their teams. Like Blackrock has been brilliant, and only for the support of Pinergy as well. Like our team is very well supported, and the lads in the club know what Pinergy are, the women's sponsor. And we've had a really good relationship with them. So we have one of the best support structures in the club, from the exec, from the lads, and just the sponsors in general. So it's nice that we can kind of build to potentially progress, but I think it comes from having a good underlying infrastructure, as in a good AIL. competitive AIL before any of that kind of starts.
And what is the standard like at the moment in comparison to England?
Well, it's at the minute there's a bit of a split. Blackrock are third, so that's brilliant. We're in the top, so we're looking forward to hopefully a semi-finals in the AIL. So that's nice, and that was kind of our goal this year. So we'll keep pushing on and see what happens then come end of April.
Very good. What was your own sporting backgrounds when you were younger, leading up to the point where you're involved in sailing, triathlon, rugby? Were you people who played a lot of different things, and when it got to a stage in your life decided, no, this is the one I like to do? Or were you kind of one sport people? Who wants to take this one first?
Every sport under the sun. Every one night a week, maybe two sports, like some nights and everything. I think it got to a stage where Mam had to sit me down and be like, right, look, you need to give up a few sports.
It's just starting enough hours in the day.
Yeah, I think I have two older brothers, so I was very competitive with them. And it finally got whittled down to horse riding and sailing, and Dad said he wouldn't buy me a pony. So I was like, right.
What else was in there in the mix?
Camogie, Gaelic football, tennis. Those are the main ones, yeah.
And at what point did you kind of realise I could potentially go to an Olympics here with this? At what point did you move beyond like kind of doing it for fun and doing it to the point where you're doing it competitively and you're very, very good at it?
I think because I'm a competitive person, it was always like any sport I did, it was obviously I was enjoying it and doing it for fun, but it was always like, I want to be good at it and I want to, I'm not doing it and...
Unless I'm going to the Olympics.
But like Owen, my older brother, he picked sailing and was doing that competitively, and he was quite good at it. And I was so competitive with him that I was like, right, well, if you're good at it, I'm going to be better. And then I think it was when I was going into TY, and I was really looking forward to TY because I could sail loads and didn't really have to go to school. And that was the year that I was like, started doing senior events and like was going to sailing events and seeing Olympic gold medalists and like maybe like beating them for a while in a race and saying, oh, maybe I could go to the Olympics as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was it pretty much.
And Alva, for you, what were you like?
So I also have two older brothers. That might be a tip thing, but it's a competitive feature brother thing. But I grew up with Camogie and horse riding as well. So none of those are remotely related to triathlon. But I had a school friend when I was in fourth year as well, actually, who was doing the Great North Run. And she was like, Alva, let's go do it. And I was like, all right, okay, we'll just go do a 10K. Let's have the crack. And that was it, really. I was just kind of hooked on competitive endurance sport from there. So I'm from Rosgray, and there was a triathlon on in Nina, which ended up being my club from once I'd done the race. So I told my dad I was going to do this race, so I didn't have a bike. It's obviously a big part of a triathlon. So we went and got a bike from the local shop down in Rosgray. I think it was around £300, which was, or euro even. I was like, oh my God, like such an expensive bike. I now realise that is not an expensive bike. But I got my €300 bike anyway and went away over to Nina. Did that triathlon, and then I was like, oh, it's kind of fun, like get stuck in. I ended up doing quite a bit of training with Nina Tri Club at the time, which just happened to be all male, which again, just it's fun beating boys. So I was like, okay, this is great, like I can maybe get my head stuck in here, see what happens. And then I eventually went to, that would have been TY, so then I went to college in UL, which is obviously a very sporty college. Found a good group there and just got stuck in, and here I am a few years later still doing it. So
what's your, have you a preference or a one strength in the triathlon?
I'm a swim biker, really. That's my, some, the front end of the race is kind of my strength. But my favorite thing to do is run, so it's a little bit weird. you don't usually like the thing you're not, or yeah, that you're least good at. But I do, I love a long run. That's like my favorite session of the week. So
what's the toughest part physically, do you think, in it? Or is it just the stage that it's at, like the run might be the finish? Because I asked this because last summer several members of the OTB team did like a leg each of a triathlon, and my God, did they talk about it nonstop for about 2-3 months.
Yeah.
Each one was doing the toughest part.
Yeah, of course they were. So I think for us, so we race draft legal, which means we ride in a group, so we're not separated by a 10-meter draft zone or whatever it is. So actually the toughest part in our style of racing is probably the like the unexpected nature of like the sprints in the group. So anything steady state is very manageable because you can just ride to a number or ride to a heart rate or whatever it might be. But in our type of racing, when you're riding in a group, there are kind of peaks and troughs, and those peaks are the things that can kind of catch you off guard. And if you don't have that kind of outright power to kind of go with it, like that is the toughest bit. So yeah, that bit hurts.
And Michelle, what was your background?
Football when I was growing up, GAA. Yeah. So playing for Offaly for a couple of years, and then I went to college and I played a bit of tag there. And then...
Is that what led it into rugby, is it?
Yeah, a little bit. I was on a cooperative education, so co-op from UL. So I was up in Dublin playing tag, and sure, I went back to Limerick. So instead of fourth year in school, it was fourth year in college that I took up rugby. And I just absolutely loved it. And then moved up to Dublin after I finished in Limerick and joined Blackrock. Never thought I'd ever play for Ireland. And because my mother was always like, please give that up. Like, you've had enough serious injuries now, Michelle. Like, that's enough of it. I'm like, yeah, Ma, when I play for Ireland, that's when I give it up. Full of thinking that I'll never get to play and she'll never get this come true. But then last year I injured my ankle during the game against Italy. And first question, Mum was like, so when do you think you'll be able to get back to play, Michelle? Like, to complete 360, just loves it. And because it's that easy, Mum, to get back into the international team, I'll just, you know, train a bit.
And was it something with, as soon as you really got in, as soon as you really started playing it, you just kind of had the bug for it?
Oh yeah, and the friends you make, and I just made, because you moved to a new city, you didn't know anyone, and then these girls just became my friends so quickly, and they're your support network then you're here, and I just absolutely loved it, and they were brilliant to me. And it's just, you enjoy going training, you enjoy seeing them, and you might lose 80-0 to Limerick against UL in your first year, but she might win the next one. They kind of build from there, and then yeah, just absolutely loved it.
I think anecdotally, a lot of players in Ireland, particularly in rugby, are probably picking it up in like the kind of early 20s and stuff like that, much later than, you know, the way a standard kid is playing camogie or ladies football or something like that. Are we kind of seeing it push back now towards getting a lot more kids involved?
Yeah, it's a massive shift. Like there's four or five girls that are under 20 that are on the international squad at the minute, and then you have girls who are playing Leinster under teens. I was involved with Leinster under teens sevens over the summer last year, and they're coming from clubs all over the place, and the growth of the sport has been phenomenal at the underage level. And that's what you need, it's the grassroots rugby that's kind of coming through. And these girls are phenomenal, and they're going to be amazing, because say my rugby age is 10, but these girls have been playing since they've been seven, so by the time they get to 21 they'll have whatever 14 years of playing, as opposed to me who was zero. So the rugby age is definitely, it's changing, and the kind of the change of the sport has been brilliant.
And is a huge part of that down to the exposure that women's rugby has had in Ireland across probably the last 8-10 years? The way you would have had the women's team winning a Grand Slam, going on to the semi-finals of World Cup, beating New Zealand, things like that, and so much of it happening on free-to-air TV for everyone to see, and all of a sudden the role models are there in front of you. They're much more accessible than they would have been in the past.
People are introduced to the sport as well. Yeah. People didn't really probably know that there was such a big part of the country's sport was women's rugby. It's had one of the most successful in the past decade. It's been really successful, and they've got to a semi-final place for World Cup. Like, they've just incredibly grown. And to be on telly, it's normal. People see it. Like that first game against Italy, I think, where they won the Grand Slam, and Claire Malone nearly got hypothermia, or did get hypothermia from the weather. But like, it makes it real, and parents are able to see that it's not, it is rough because it's a contact sport.
But and like, someone's getting hypothermia.
Yeah, but like,
it's grand.
That was just the weather that day. It doesn't always happen that way. But it's just like you see big and small, like it's a team for everyone that's there, and girls can fit in, and they can see that they're welcome there, and like you're all learning together because everyone's new to it. So it's a nice introduction to it. But yes, I definitely believe that free-to-air television, commentary, newspapers, like this is going to get big, and it's only going to get bigger. So this is the start of something.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, it was International Women's Day last Sunday, so there was a huge focus on things like the 20 by 20 movement and the commentary on just how much it's doing, trying to push female athletes like front and centre, putting faces out there and making them recognisable, because ultimately that's what's going to inspire kids.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the most common video, or the 2020 The Stripes video that I've seen recently, is Ciara McGeehan, and obviously she's had a fantastic year last year. I know athletics is kind of, it's an accessible sport, like it's just kind of rock up and run. You don't need a boat or a bike or whatever it might be. But I just think what Ciara in particular has done is great, and she's made her achievements on the world stage very normal almost, and kind of, God, I can do that. And if there's little kids out there watching that, I just think that's great. Like, it's amazing. Mm-hmm.
And like, we would have had, I know last Sunday on our Sunday paper, we would have had Sarah O'Donovan, ex Cork and Dublin camogie player, and she was saying, like, for example, that she was saying she remember it was probably about 15 years or so ago, and there was, she says it was a Lucozade ad, and Cora Staunton was on it, and she was pointing out, like at that point there were no real, you know, women being used as marketing tools on big companies and advertisements and stuff, and she was saying that, like, that was just an eye-opening experience for her as a young athlete, kind of seeing someone out there that a company decided Cora Staunton is a huge name, and regardless whether she's a man or a woman, she's going to sell this product and she's going to be instantly recognisable.
Yeah, I think a lot more companies are kind of realising that now, like, it's not just about the big dogs in the male side of sport, and I think you are seeing a lot more female faces on the front of these ads, and that's just great. Like, I know growing up, like, when I first started in triathlon, one of the most prominent names on the triathlon scene was Gavin Noble, so he was a male. So I emailed him as a young girl, being like, hi, like, what do I do with the sport? Like, tell me what to do. But, like, I didn't know that there were, I knew that there were girls in it, but they weren't as, they just weren't as mainstream. I didn't think they were anyway, so they weren't, I couldn't go snooping and find their email address to email them, but, like, I could get his. But there's so many girls out there now, and I mean, social media, although it has its cons, it also has its pros, and that people can contact their heroes, as it might be, and their, everything's just more accessible, and it's more, it's made out to be more achievable now, so you can go and chase that dream as a young kid if you want.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel some bit of a kind of a responsibility to go out and try encourage people to be getting involved in sport?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I just, well, I see it more as, like, it's a great opportunity for me that I can go out and encourage young girls, not just not to sail, but to keep up with sport throughout school. And I think one major part in girls and everybody's life is leaving cert, and I think loads of girls give up on sport and leaving cert because they have to study. I think if Ireland, maybe as a nation, or if we can do something to rectify that, or to teach people how to balance sport and study, you'll see a lot more girls keeping up their sport when in college and as they grow up. That's probably it. I think that's an area that is quite important and could make a big difference for women in sport in Ireland.
In sailing, what are the kind of participation levels of people, male and female, that are just involved in it for the social aspect, for the fitness side of things, going out and just, you know, being involved in a sport as opposed to being in the competitive side of things?
Yeah, sailing's a hugely social sport as well. Like, in Dublin, there's a load of yacht racing and stuff at the weekend, and it's not that, you don't have to be, like, very physically fit for that bit. If, like, there's jobs on the boat that you don't have to, and then there's also, you can go on a boat and not really know that much about sailing, so that's pretty good. But it's very male dominated, especially outside Olympic sailing. It's hugely male dominated. You hardly see any girls on big boats now, but there's a movement at the moment for the Volvo Ocean Race, which is a yacht race around the world, to get some of the boats have to have half male, half female. So that's class, because that's hardly ever happened before.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts then on, like, quotas in sport? Do you see it as something that kind of has to be done to help out for the long time, or is there an element of, you know, people say it's tokenism, it's people not being selected on merit, that, you know, they're being forced to pick certain people?
I think at the start, quotas a good thing, because it'll encourage more involvement of sporting bodies and to try and encourage females.
So playing the long game.
And I don't think I think anyone who's qualified enough should be involved, and maybe sometimes women are overlooked, or else their presence isn't as much known. But for the outset, I think it's good because it'll start driving investment and it'll start encouraging people to kind of look into it. Like even now, I think with referees for rugby, like there is a big drive for women and there's fast track and there's some really good female referees coming through. And that's brilliant to see because they're part of the game and it's just becoming normal. So at the minute, quotas, yeah, great. But long run, I don't think it's something which is we can rely upon. But I think we'll get to a point that you're encouraging people to get involved and then it'll just become normal.
Yeah, you're trying to get to the point where a quota isn't needed down the line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Also then as well, one thing you kind of touched on there is aside from getting girls and boys involved at a young age, but particularly girls that drop out like maybe towards the end of school, like what you were saying with exams and things like that, is there a big struggle getting them back involved then a few years later?
I think it's quite sport dependent. So something like swimming, I didn't do it as a kid, but I've heard many a story that like they'll get to like 15 or 16 and they're just absolutely sick of staring at the black line at the bottom of the pool. They'll give it up, and then something like swimming that's so specific, if you leave it and try and come back to it, more often than not, it is very difficult. I mean, it can obviously be done. But it's not a social sport, swimming. Well, it is before and after the session. It's great because your friends are, they're all there and it's wonderful. But like, obviously, your head in the water, you can't exactly, you know, have full-blown conversation like running where you're running along and you can actually hold a conversation. So I think it is quite sport specific, but that's actually for swimmers who do drop out quite early, that's kind of where triathlon can kind of come into their lives. So they do get back in the pool, but it's not 14 sessions a week, it's only 4 or 5, and then the rest is made up of bike and run. So there are kind of talent transfer programs that you can do from one sport to the next, and that is definitely a good route to go down if sport is something that you love and you do want to get back into it. But I think your head has to be ready to get back into it too, because I'm just thinking of swimming specifically, where you've come from early mornings and potentially evening swims after school as well, it can be quite a drain mentally. So I think you do need to be ready and prepped to get back in and just enjoy doing the sport.
For trying to encourage people to get back into it, Michelle, for example, like, what is it like in terms of rugby at Blackrock? Is it like an open door policy? If someone wants to come along.
Oh, anyone is welcome to come down to Blackrock Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Regardless,
7 o'clock. Regardless of your ability, you have two teams with J1 side, and we've got a senior team. They're competing in the Leinster League at the minute and they're doing really well. So, like, we need numbers of training. We want people to enjoy it. So, that's the purpose. We've got our league campaigns going towards an end. That's a cup campaign in the Leinster League. So, like, it's brilliant to have people come down because you have transfer athletes, a lot of Gaelic, a lot of soccer, got jiu-jitsu. So these are required skill sets for rugby as well. You know, anyone can try. I've tried Alva, but Sean, come. You're next.
Sorry. Did you ever give rugby a shot? You're not Alva, no?
No, well, Dad, it's in my genes. Like, Dad grew up playing rugby, but I don't know, it just, no. Not yet.
Is it something you miss now that you're doing individual sports and yourself as well, Aisling, the team environment?
Well, like Aisling was saying earlier, she trains with all of her people trying to get in the same boat, and I am the same. Like, we train in a group, so although it's an individual sport, you do most of your training as a team. So we don't have that kind of on-pitch bond like you might have, but we do have a bond in a different way, and we're all trying to achieve very similar goals, so therefore it's kind of in our interest to work well as a team and kind of learn those skills, and then you can bring those kind of skills into race day as well, where you are an individual and you are standing on your own two feet and every woman for themselves on the start line. But we do dip into that team environment. It's just not as much as obviously a team sport does,
because it is a huge thing, kind of just from a social thing and a mental health thing. Like, I found in the last couple of months, I recently went back playing rugby after 5 years away from it. And initially I was going back just because I kind of wanted to get back playing a little bit. But it was only after a few weeks I realised one thing I did actually miss a huge amount was the team environment and being around, and, you know, after a match last week, hanging around and having a couple of drinks with people and just chatting away, watching a match on TV. Stuff like that, it's it's huge for from a mental and physical point of view.
Yeah, and I think as well, well when I started to now, like WhatsApp as well, you've WhatsApp groups and you've got your social groups and like the cracky do we have in those.
I mean, you have to mute them half the time.
They're all muted. They're all muted. And then when you have a free 10 minutes, it starts scrolling through. But that's definitely one thing I absolutely love. And like, it's the camaraderie, the friends, the relationships for life that you make. And it's just brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Who were the idols growing up for you?
Well, Annalise Murphy was mine, and now it's funny that I'm competing against her. But like, as in, for my Junior Cert Art project, I painted Annalise, and now I'm like,
have you ever told her about it?
I told her, yeah, and it was like her campaign for real, and I'm like, I've never showed her, but now, yeah, it's a bit strange, but yeah, she was my one of my, and Sonia O'Sullivan, because I forgot to mention, I was doing cross country when I was younger as well. And when I was in Australia there, Sonia actually came out with us one day, because she lives in Melbourne. And that was crazy, like,
just
being
like
around.
Pinch yourself moment.
But it was like two of the most like known female athletes in Ireland. And we were just all hanging around the boat park together. Like, I don't know how many other female Olympic medalists there are in Ireland, apart from Annalise and Sonia. That was class.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine. John Leahy was my idol growing up. Yeah, I grew up playing Camogie, so I guess that kind of does make sense. But yeah, John Leahy, I loved him. And I remember I met him one day. It was after he long retired at this point, but we were in Croke Park watching a game, and he just happened to be sitting beside us. And Dad was like, Alva. Oh my God. And he signed my programme, and I still have it at home in my drawer. He was, yeah, that was a big moment for me.
Yeah. And Michelle, what about yourself?
Oh God, I don't know. I remember sitting up and watching like the Olympics that was on. Is it Atlanta? Yeah, I think 96. It was like, maybe I was very young, I don't remember. yeah, and just kind of seeing the females that on the telly that and the Kiri lights to play, just I kind of remember it's in my aunt's house, just so vivid. Yeah, just any kind of females that were on in those kind of environments, you're like, wow, it's really achievable. And it's those moments you remember. So I think even with the GEA being on telly and the Crow Park being filled, that they're all in finals, so you can see it. And like they say, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And it really is true. It just stands here, like even with the Leaving Cert Art project.
Before we finish up then, what are the kind of the remaining goals for 2020? Obviously for yourselves and the Six Nations, it's been a bit disjointed. Overall, with the three games you've had so far, what has been the general feeling of it? It was two good wins to start off with. Obviously, yeah. England was going to be an uphill task completely, but there were big celebrations after those first two games. It really looked like that last year had been such a disappointment for Ireland, and it kind of felt like this season things are getting back on track a little.
Yeah, like this is a big year for us with World Cup qualification in kind of September. So even if the games are cancelled, we still are preparing for those, and it's going to be a big year, like I said. But Wales, Scotland, the wins are very important. We've moved up in the world rankings. We're up to 8th, I think, now. So it's good progression. It's a good start for the summer, kind of the prep, and then the games in September. So if we can play the games this weekend, fantastic. If not, we're going to start moving on, then looking towards September.
We could have actually recorded two versions of this chat. One of them lamenting the France game being postponed, and the other one, oh, you know, it's really looking forward to this game now.
Really,
it's going to be a big challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
Alva, for yourself, obviously you were saying Tokyo is probably something that's probably a little bit beyond you at this stage.
Yeah.
How does the goal reset? What's 2020 looking like for you?
So last season I was absent really from international racing. So my main goal is just to get myself back there. Do myself justice on the international scene and kind of move on from there then. So yeah, travel. Travel to some nice races and do some nice races. So.
And Aisling, your goal obviously is knock Annalise off her perch and have her paint you for a project.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in the middle of Olympic trials at the moment. So the next regatta is in 2 weeks in Palma, and one after that in Hyères in France. So it's going to be an intense couple of weeks ahead of me, but I was disappointed in my results at the Worlds there at the end of February, so I'm determined to redeem myself now at the next event in Palma.
And even with those, is there any danger that they might not go ahead?
Palma is looking likely to go ahead now. Hyères, I suppose, we'll have to see closer to the time. But I'd say because Palma's an island, I don't think that will be postponed, but it's going ahead in my head now anyways. So.
Yeah. the way you have to go about it. Ailva Carroll, Aislinn Keller and Alva Carroll, Aislinn Keller and Michelle Claffey, thanks a million for coming in and joining us this afternoon for our Saturday panel brought to you by Pinergy. The Pinergy Passions programme is now in its third year, created in 2017 with the aim of supporting young talented people with a passion by enabling them to dedicate more time and focus to their chosen passions.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.